interview with William Bill Challis at the Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival in Davenport, Iowa, on August 5th, 1972. Challis was the one probably who knew Bix best in the later years. The questions that I asked him had mostly to do with, at the first part, I interviewed him for over 2 hours, had to do mostly in the first part with Bix himself. I asked him first about Bix's later years, the movement toward composing and toward piano. He said that unlike the reports in the books, Bix did not come to his apartment and compose on his piano. He said that he found a piano somewhere and would come to his apartment, that is Challis's, with ideas, things written down, and that he and Challis would continue to work them out on the piano. He said that Bix had tremendous innate musical talent, and that while they were working out these piano pieces and other pieces, that he would say to Bix, "Now, is this exactly the way you want it?" And Bix would perhaps change his mind and find a little different way. It was Challis and Bix together, apparently, who wrote down the piano pieces. Challis said that he was working now on a five-guitar arrangement of Bix's piano pieces because, he said, the people who orchestrate them, make arrangements for them, tend to improvise on Bix's melodies, which was not the point. While this is perfectly natural for musicians to improvise on melodies, he wanted to get the pieces themselves in relatively pure form. Guitars he chose because he can, using five guitars, get rich and complex harmonies that he feels these pieces deserve. He's looking now for the right kind of guitar. He wants somebody who can play this kind of thing directly from notes and on an F guitar. I asked Challis about Bix's knowledge of music, his ability to write, and from what I gathered from his remarks, it was perfectly clear that Bix had a great deal of musical knowledge. He was able to write music. He did know the musical terms. He and Challis, although Challis is much more expert than he was, worked together on the later music. Another interesting thing, Challis said that in the arrangements that he made for Whiteman, leaving open holes for soloists, that he and Bix would get together beforehand and decide more or less what Bix's approach or pattern might be. That while these were improvised, they were at the same time rather somewhat carefully planned beforehand. He said he did this with all of Whiteman's soloists. With Bix, this accounts for the fact that in a number of different takes on a piece, he may have slightly different approaches, but they will sort of hew to the same pattern. Bix was, in the later years, Challis said, tremendously knowledgeable about music. The composers that Bix listened to carefully and were most deeply influenced him, Challis said, were, as I had already guessed, McDowell and Eastwood Lane and his Adirondack sketches, Debussy, Stravinsky, Ravel, and Frederick Delius. It was Delius, Challis said, who had a great influence on Bix's musical thinking. I asked him, too. I said, "Mr. Challis, you've been quoted as saying that Bix was influenced by Ethel Waters' phrasing," and he said that's right. He admired Ethel Waters' singing a great deal. He also said, of course, that Bix mentioned Nick LaRocca as one of the early trumpeters that he heard. Challis went on to say, however, that Bix liked or had something good to say about practically all trumpeters or all musicians that he heard, that he was that kind of man who would never say anything about anybody that might be hurtful or ungenerous. So therefore, when being interviewed or in conversation, when somebody would say, "Do you like so-and-so on a trumpet?" Bix would say, "Certainly, he's very good." So therefore, this probably accounts for all the different writers saying that Bix was influenced by Tommy Ladner and Joe Smith and so-and-so, because Bix, an amenable and friendly guy, would simply go on and say, "Yes, you know, I like him very much. I've listened to him, and he's very good." What Challis said about Bix's music was, first of all, he used the term economy, an economy of notes. a matter of taste. Bix, he said, used very few notes, that he was constantly eliminating notes and frills from his music, and that the word that kept in his mind was economy. I suggested a restraint, and he said, yes, that also was an excellent word. Bix, he said, had an unerring ear, and inside his head, and he tapped his head as he was saying this, a tremendous knowledge and a tremendous skill in music. Bix was, according to Challis, much more musically expert than the legend has it. He, after all, was a professional musician. He studied hard and worked hard, that he was very much interested in composing in the latter part of his career. I asked Challis several things about his exchanges with Don Redman and other black composers. He didn't really have much to say to him. Redman and the others were simply good musicians. He didn't see much difference in tradition, I could gather. He did, however, say one or two things that were quite interesting when he was talking about Bix and black musicians. He said that he, that is Challis, simply didn't really like too well the black approach to music. He felt that so many black musicians took great risks, that their taste was really not controlled, that they preferred to be pyrotechnical, to play far too many notes, to overdo it a bit. As he said, they always do things a little too much. He didn't mention any specific musicians here, but, well, he did, too. He mentioned, for one thing, Bobby Hackett, of course, who wasn't black. He said Hackett plays far too many notes. And he said the same thing, more or less, about Armstrong, although he had great admiration for Armstrong, and it was his pyrotechnical quality. In talking about Bix's horn, this came about as part of the same conversation, that Bix strove, he said, for a mellow tone, a mellow feel, and Challis used that word mellow several times in relation to Bix's music. He said, interestingly enough, that he and Bix, I believe it was in Sweet Sue for perhaps the first time, that he suggested to Bix that Bix use a hat to play into a derby to get a different kind of mellow tone. This, of course, gives the lie to the legend that Bix began playing into a derby because his tone, his embouchure, was going bad, and this was to hide lapses in tone. He said that this was simply all there was to it, as an experiment to see if he could get a mellower, a different kind of tone. Challis, incidentally, wrote that arrangement of Sweet Sue, which he said really wasn't that much. He said the only good thing about it was the preparation I made for Bix, and he said I made him the best kind of backing there was. Lenny Hayden apparently helped somewhat on that arrangement, too. Challis made the point in conversation with me that Bix always kept within the cornet range. He didn't, and here again, Challis mentioned black players, he didn't try to push the instrument into ranges or beyond boundaries where it really wasn't fitted to go. This is a point I myself had made earlier, I think, in that paper on Bix, that he treated it as an instrument. I said to Challis, my interpretation of this would be that Bix was playing an instrument and realized it was an instrument and kept it an instrument, that he wasn't imitating the human voice, that he played a cornet like a cornet. And Challis more or less said, well, yes, something of that sort. He said Bix didn't like a trumpet tone, that he felt it wasn't, and again he used the word mellow enough. Curiously enough, and this I have to explain a little bit more, he said 80% of the chorus material he wrote for Bix was in four flats. A flat, that is, I guess, and B flat on a cornet. That he said, first of all, Bix's high B flat was absolutely perfect, and therefore when he wrote for Bix, he tended to use that as sort of the high tone that Bix could do and do well. There were Challis as an arranger was interesting in this score. I didn't realize that an arranger paid so much attention to the individual musician and his capabilities. Apparently he did this in his own arranging. In arranging for Whiteman, I asked Challis about this, about who the arrangers were. Well, there were lots of them, of course. Apparently he and Tom Satterfield, that is Challis and Tom Satterfield, did a lot of work. Matty Malnick arranged for them too in some of the smaller bands. Lenny Hayton helped as well. But the impression I got from Challis was that he and Satterfield did most of the sort of swinging material. Grofay wasn't interested in this. Challis had great respect and admiration for Grofay as a musician, but apparently Grofay wasn't particularly interested in that kind of arranging. Challis was one of the most important men, it seemed to me, at this conference. it's he who spans really quite an era in jazz. Actually, in his lifetime, what was happening was the movement from unarranged to arranged jazz. He came on the scene, I believe, in about 1925, and this was just at the point where unarranged jazz, more or less, was changing into arranged jazz. Then he kept on in the middle 60s. He was close friends with the Dorseys. Interestingly enough, he said he had never arranged for them. He arranged for Golket, Whiteman, Castle, Omanach, Hillcrit. Later on, tried to go into radio work. Chalice was talking about arranging at the time, and he said, first of all, that in the 20s it was a paradise for arrangers because dance bands were very popular, and there were all sorts of bands springing up, and there just weren't enough arrangers to go around. So there were a lot of musicians in bands who were frustrated arrangers, and until this time had not really had a chance to do much arranging. He said that he was a slow arranger, that two or three arrangements a week was about all he could do, because he said he worked carefully at them. He likes harmonies, and he said, for example, a lot of people could turn out arrangements rather swiftly by doubling parts. He said, for example, that he'd take there'd be a band playing in a big dance hall, and the PA systems weren't very good, and usually were not even there. And so the arranger would talk to the band manager, who'd talk to the dance hall manager, and say, look, if we want to be heard, I'm going to have to add a sax and two horns. And this gave the arranger then a new problem. And he said most arrangers, if they added, say, another tenor or a baritone sax, would simply double a tenor part or an alto part an octave below or something like this. But same thing with horn. But he didn't like to do this. He liked harmonies. So therefore, he was a slow arranger. And while he said he could have made a lot of money in radio and perhaps more money in arranging, that he just really couldn't work that way. But there's Chalice, I think, a key man in this whole affair, covering that area. He said that the arrangement of Clementine, that's often attributed to him, really isn't his, that he was gone for a couple weeks from the band when the Golket band recorded there that and several other tunes. Basically, I gathered, the arrangement was sort of his, but in his absence, Itzy Riskin, he said, was somebody fooled with this. Maybe Malnack did too, he couldn't quite remember. I asked him about Steve Brown, who came from the New Orleans Rhythm Kings to Golket, and seemed to me added a lot to the band, a great deal of lift. He said, yes, Brown did, that he had a tremendous gift for this kind of thing. He said he actually wasn't a first-rate musician, that he didn't play a lot of figures, that he really was more a rhythm man than he was a player, but that his sense of rhythm and the background, the bottom that he gave to the band made a lot of difference to it. He said, for example, he wasn't really a musicianly bass man like Artie Bernstein and some others who really played it. I said to Chalice, here I've been at this conference and all these people from Bix's time are here and they're willing to talk about Bix. They want to talk about Bix, and the man has been dead for 40 years. What was it that in his lifetime and afterwards drew people to Bix? He said, and he used the word, he said that Bix was in a sense lovable, that he was kind and gentle and the kind of person that you wanted to protect and to help, and also that he, like other musicians, respected his incredible talent and his dedication to his craft. He told a number of a few incidents about Bix, who apparently was very careless about changing his clothes and his socks, and who had a kind of irresponsibility, nothing vicious or anything of the sort. He just tended not to get places on time and that kind of thing. But it was perfectly clear at this conference that these men who, you know, themselves were first-rate musicians and were part of this whole very important period, were perfectly willing to sort of subordinate themselves and talk about Bix. I talked to Chalice for 2 hours, and I wanted to talk more to Chalice about himself, but many times the conversation would veer back to Bix quite naturally, even after all this time. So he said the Bix myth was had already started long before he died, of the man of great talent and great genius who was somewhat irresponsible and who needed people to look after him and who was lovable. And I said I had understood that Bix had never said anything bad about anybody, And he said this was true, that Vix always had something good to say about everybody. He said that he had sort of roomed with Vix, in a sense, and saw that he got places. Tell me a long story about their going to Atlantic City and how Vix disappeared. Apparently he was drinking very heavily in the last years, but he simply drained parts of bottles as if they were water. He didn't overstress this, though. My impression was that a lot of musicians, or some musicians at least, did much the same thing. Chalice himself was only a social drinker. He said he just drank on occasion, and people did. He seemed to be very conservative and very straight kind of man. I talked for a little while with Chauncey Morehouse. Morehouse broke into big-time work with Paul Specht in 1922 as drummer. He played with the Gold Kett Group as drummer from 1925 to 1927. He worked with Adrian Rollini and did studio work. He also worked with Ted Weems and others. Specht's band, he said, was relief band for Whiteman at the Palais Royal, and he worked some for Whiteman, too. I asked him about Whiteman, and he said that Whiteman was, first of all, a man who respected good musicianship. He said that he, Morehouse, while he wasn't a spectacular drummer, was the best timekeeper among drummers, and that he said Paul went through drummers pretty fast. He hired McDonald and he hired a number of people, but he would often come back to Morehouse and get him for jobs because he was a superb timekeeper. He also said that Whiteman was really universally liked, that he had a temper, and that sometimes he'd fire people and then, you know, rehire them 10 minutes later. And he said that the fact that they called him Pops and things like this was quite indicative of the way musicians felt about him. He said Paul really wasn't any violinist and never pretended to be, but he was a skilled musician and a great appreciation for musicianship. I talked with Bill Rank. I talked with him mostly about Whiteman. The point he made about Whiteman is pretty much what Morehouse made, the respect for good musicianship. And also he said that Whiteman was always looking up new talent. That one of the young men that I'd been talking to earlier, a young fellow from Michigan, when I was talking about Whiteman, called him contemptuously the Lawrence Welk of the times, and this Rank simply exploded when I asked him about this. He said nothing of the sort. He said the only thing that he could see about Whiteman was like Welk was that he looked up new talent, that he was always finding somebody good, or at least somebody Whiteman thought was good, and giving him a tryout, putting him in the contributions to the profession, is the fact that